Welcome to the ProPublica podcast. I'm Julia Angwin, senior reporter here at ProPublica, and today I'm joined by Brandon Smith, freelance journalist from Chicago, who's best known for fighting the FOIA lawsuit that won the release of the Laquan McDonald video showing an unarmed man being shot to death by the police. Brandon, thanks for joining.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about the Laquan McDonald video, how you won its release. Apparently, it was known that it existed, but you were the only person who sued for it?
I was. I mean, I was the plaintiff in the lawsuit, and I was put onto the case by a friend of mine, Will Calloway. He was following in the footsteps of another independent journalist, Jamie Calvin. So essentially, this was just a bunch of people who were not affiliated with any large news operation, just trying to pick up the slack where everyone else was not doing the work of the people.
Now, remind listeners what the video showed and how it contradicted what the police had alleged.
Well, the initial police story was that one shot was fired at this 17-year-old boy and it killed him. And the shot was fired in self-defense because the young man lunged at the officer with a knife. The young man, Laquan McDonald, was carrying a knife, but it was pretty clear from the video that he was walking away from officers, or at least mostly walking away, kind of walking past them, right? The video basically shows the officer just unloading the gun on him, and two shots put him on the ground, and the other 14 were as he's just lying there on the ground. And so it's pretty gruesome, and other officers on the scene there watched it, and they lied in their official reports. So it's kind of an open question, like, what exactly did they see? What can we prove that they saw? Because at least some of them are liable to face a perjury charge.
And the officer himself who shot all these bullets at this man, is he on trial now? And was that prompted by the release of the video?
Well, the state's attorney's office would say that it was not prompted by the release of the video, but they waited 13 months to charge him with murder, and they only filed the charge after the judge in my case ruled that the video had to come out.
So in advance of the video actually coming out.
That's right. So the judge ruled, and then like the next day, I think, the charges were filed, and then a couple days later,
I'm sure that was totally coincidental.
just like 400 police shootings in 6 years, two of them were recommended for discipline. Like, that's just a coincidence, right?
Is that really the number?
That's right.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So that's the agency, Independent Police Review Authority. It's independent in name only, and they supposedly investigate police, and I'm still looking into their policies, but there's a whistleblower from that agency who's come out and given reporters emails. He oversaw a small team of investigators, and several times in his career, he tried to recommend discipline for an officer who was being accused of misconduct, right? Well, his bosses would not let him recommend discipline. He would pass up the chain this note saying, like, yeah, this officer was in the wrong. That's my finding. And his bosses would say, nope, that's not your finding. And when he objected, they fired him. And that's when he took emails and gave them to reporters in Chicago. So we know it doesn't work.
So tell me a little more about the TikTok of the timeline of how you were able to win this lawsuit. Let's start from the beginning. So when the incident happened, was it suspicious at that time that you wanted to start looking into it?
I was kind of detained from working on a few stories, and this was one of them. I was mostly interested in whether police confiscated guns from the scenes where they shot people, because so many police shootings are reported where the person who was shot was carrying a gun, and that was why deadly force was used on the part of police. I wanted to know whether they had guns in evidence, you know, whether they recovered a gun. So I was trying to do sort of this big picture story on that topic when someone told me about Laquan's story. You know, it wasn't particularly suspicious until Jamie Calvin wrote that piece on on the autopsy.
Remind us of the timeline. So in November, Laquan was shot and killed. And when did the piece come out about the autopsy?
That was in February. So then about a month later, I filed a FOIA request, Freedom of Information request about the video. And also I asked, well, who else has filed the same request? Please show me your response to those folks.
And how many people had filed requests?
14 different people. No one else was an independent, really. Everyone was working for one of about 10 news organizations. Now, all of those organizations received denials, and no one else filed suit against the government for the denial. The Wall Street Journal did take their denial to the Illinois Attorney General's office, which is another route that you have to protest if you're denied a FOIA request. They eventually got back a non-binding opinion, which means very little. It only means something if you can take it to court and show the judge, like, hey, like, here's what the Attorney General of this state thinks.
I see. So you went straight to court instead of the Attorney General route. So tell me, how did you find a lawyer to represent you, and how did that work?
I knew an attorney who filed FOIA suits. We went back a little ways. He helped me file a FOIA suit a year or so before. So that's kind of how my friend got in touch with me. My friend William Calloway, he's an activist in Chicago, black activist on the South Side, and he's following a lot of police brutality cases.
William Calloway reached out to you, and then you reached out to your lawyer, and you guys filed suit how many months after the denial?
If the shooting happened in October, and I requested the video in March, I filed suit in August, and the video came out in November.
That's actually pretty speedy once you got to court.
Yeah, for a court case, I'm told that's pretty fast. The judge was pretty lenient about, you know, we asked him, like, hey, please speed this up. Like, this is, like, really important. If the Freedom of Information Act is for anything, it's for this case, because this is a case wherein a representative of the government literally killed someone, and people want to know why.
Now tell us, everyone has heard the story about how you were actually barred from the press conference when the video was released. There was an article in the New York Times about that. So tell us about that.
The straightforward reason is that I didn't have press credentials to get into this conference, the press conference that my lawsuit created. The presser was about the release of the video. It was held to announce the release of the video and for the mayor to weigh in on how it's, you know, it's a terrible thing, but it's not a pattern. Of course, it was a pattern. 85% of what the mayor said in that press conference was how the city is great and is doing good things and the police are doing good work. Well, yes, in many cases, but like we're here to talk about when they don't do good things, right? So let's talk about that. Anyway, I was ostensibly barred from the press conference because I didn't have credentials. And everyone wondered about that decision because my lawsuit caused the video release. Well, I got to thinking later, everyone was suspicious. Like, do they just want to silence this independent journalist? And I thought at first, maybe they do want to silence me. But then later, I just realized if they wanted to silence me, they could have let me into the press conference and then just not called on me when I raised my hand, because that's happened to me before. And so, yeah, I think it was mostly just this bureaucratic oversight. But the larger picture of the story, that they're not very transparent, that's a true thing.
Right. But I also think the issue of credentials is so symbolic of the whole situation that you're in, which is that you are a freelance journalist. In fact, you support your journalism with a 40-hour-a-week job as an office manager, correct?
That's right.
And so you do journalism in your free time. And this is not what traditionally has been thought of as a credentialed journalist. But on the other hand, the question in today's world where anyone can publish on the internet is what counts as journalism? Because I can't think of a better testimony to what journalism should be than forcing the release of evidence of government misconduct. And so how do you think of this? Because I know that people call you an activist and say you're not really a journalist. And so it's an interesting question that you must think about a lot.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I don't think that journalists cannot be activists. You don't want to take stands on issues without good evidence, you know, because then you're like an opinion. you're a talking head. But for me, like if something is heinous enough, you almost have to come out and take a stance against that thing. So if you're a journalist and you're reporting on the Iraq War, right, and you find that huge numbers of birth defects are occurring in areas where battles took place, then you kind of have a duty to, if someone asks you a personal question about it, which I was asked a lot of personal questions, you know, about my views on the Laquan McDonald case. If you're that Iraq war reporter, you have a duty to say this is not a cool thing that the United States government used depleted uranium bullets. Now, that's a true story. Like, the U.S. government used depleted uranium bullets in Baghdad and elsewhere in Iraq. And now the Iraqi people are suffering because the bullets are left behind. Now, not a lot of people have reported on that, but those who have reported have, like, if you ask them, they're going to say, this is not cool. Well, I don't think that makes them an activist only. They're journalists for reporting this story, trying to tell the facts.
Right. And so what you're saying is that your position is it's not cool to shoot Laquan McDonald 17 times, or how many times was it?
16 times, yeah. Not cool. And it's not cool that police have shot people in Chicago once a week for the past 29 years. That's the statistic. And it's slowed down a little bit in the past couple of years, but not by much. That's a long time that it hasn't changed.
When the video came out, it was hugely damning. And the officers involved, as you said, are now under scrutiny that they weren't before. So tell me a little bit about how you got into this type of journalism, because this is not the traditional route. You're an independent. You don't have a big newsroom behind you. You have your own affiliations. You have your lawyer. You have relationships with the activist groups. How did this path come to be? Like, how did you get? You were at a daily newspaper in Ohio. What made you decide to leave that behind and come do this in Chicago?
Those are all very different questions. I'll try to answer them last to first.
Great.
I left Ohio because I was in a reporting job where it was secure, but I had this beat where I had to cover certain things, and like I had to make sure I had a few stories every week, and those stories had to be, you know, on this topic of city government. And I did that for a while, and I just kept thinking, man, there are such bigger stories out there, you know, with national implications, many of them. And I'm literally not allowed to report on them. Or at least I had to do it at night when there are no people in their offices. You know, I can't get a hold of these people like on my off hours.
Right.
So I moved to Chicago thinking I would immediately become some great freelancer. And then it took me a couple years because I didn't know anyone and no one knew me. So I had to sort of build up these relationships with editors over a long period of time. So I think this position that I'm in is an important one. I hope the idea that I didn't have anyone to answer to was important in this case, because I didn't care if I made friends. I didn't care if I made enemies. You know, this Freedom of Information Act is really powerful in that the government has to answer you. Even if they hate your guts, they have to answer you. And frankly, a lot of reporters who work with government on a daily basis, by government, I mean, that's a huge broad term. It could mean anyone in a public agency. You don't want these people you work with all the time to hate you. And if you're suing their organization, they might not be so friendly anymore. And that's a real problem. To me, it's like journalism 101 is you got to not care who you make enemies with. And some would say you're not doing good work until you're making enemies.
That's what I tell myself every morning. But no, I think that's true. I think that my own journalism, I sort of judge it by that standard, which is if everybody's unhappy, then I feel mostly happy.
Well, everybody that's so-called important. I mean, a lot of people were happy in my case, but they were like community members. They're just like people who live near where this shooting took place, or like people who hear horror stories about how police have hassled them. They felt enfranchised by this, that there's something being done.
Right. It is so shocking that no other organization sued for it, but it's great that you did. And it does seem like a new kind of journalism maybe is only going to be possible in these different routes. I mean, certainly here at ProPublica, this is sort of our idea too, is that we're taking a different angle on it. We don't have to have beats, and we don't have to keep people on our beats happy with us and file stories every day. But one thing that's interesting about you also, though, is that you didn't even get a chance to publish on the video, right? It was released in public. Everybody wrote about it. You didn't get the scoop, which is what generally we're all in the supposed business of doing. Certainly, I feel like that's a lot of my mandate.
Well, I wrote a column the day after the video came out, and it was just a column about my reaction to the video, to seeing the video. The government is allowed to just give it to whomever it wants, just so long as it gives it to me. Like, one of the parties it gives it to was me.
Right.
Funny thing is, that happened. They sent a courier with some DVDs to my lawyer's office. That was like during this press conference where they told everyone, like, here's the URL you go to download the video. A humorous aside is that my lawyer and I were not invited to the press conference. So we found out about it secondhand and like immediately ran down there to the police headquarters to try to go there. As you said, we were not allowed in.
Who do you generally publish with, or do you have longstanding agreements, or do you just sell your stories one at a time?
It's kind of piecemeal. It's not really a living wage. It's like a few hundred bucks a pop. And it generally takes, you know, if you divide that by the number of hours that I put into a story, it's like maybe just barely a living wage, you know? That's not to disparage any news outlets. Like, that's just sort of like the going rate these days, unfortunately. I've worked with the Chicago Reader, which is the alternative weekly in Chicago. They allowed me to write the initial story back the day that I filed suit. When I say story, technically all these were op-ed columns.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the funny part about that is the editors wouldn't let me write a news piece just because I was a character in the story.
Oh, yeah, because you were the plaintiff. Right. Well, what are you doing next? Are you going to continue on this topic about police shootings? Are you going to fight more legal battles on behalf of all of us?
Criminal justice reform is a topic I'm really interested in. You know, what is working in the system? What is not? I think it's an important topic for reporters because it has so many implications about racism, systemic racism. You know, the civil rights movement is not over because we don't have wonderful civil rights in our country. You know, we should be treated equally, and we are not. So, and the criminal justice system is just one of many ways. It may be the most poignant demonstration of this, right? So I'm going to try to keep on that beat.
Well, I hope somebody funds you so you don't have to do those just in your after hours, because I think it sounds like that's a really long list of things to get done in your weekend time.
Sure.
Well, thank you for coming and joining us, and best of luck in your future FOIA battles.
Thanks, Julia.
And we'll be back here next week with the ProPublica podcast.